Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director here at the Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you all to the annual Owen Harries Lecture to be delivered by this year's Telstra Distinguished International Fellow, Ambassador Sham Saran. Before I introduce Ambassador Saran, I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge Owen Harries, who's in the audience today and in whose honour Sham is speaking. Owen is a dear friend to many of us at the Institute. He has had an illustrious career. He has been an advisor to the Fraser government. He was our ambassador to UNESCO. He was the founding editor of The National Interest, a rare Australian who's made a real impact in Washington. He has been a non-resident fellow here at the Lowy Institute for a very long time. And as well as being a font of knowledge and useful editing tips, he connects us to Washington, the United States, the wider world, and indeed to a more experienced generation of scholars. And we, in 2013, in order to recognise the huge contribution that Owen has made to the foreign relations field in Australia, but also to recognise his decade-long association with the Institute, we decided to establish the Owen Harries Lecture to be given each year by a prominent commentator on international affairs. So, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps please join me in welcoming Owen Harries. This year, again, the Harries Lecture will be given by the Telstra Distinguished International Fellow, Ambassador Sham Saran. Let me tell you a bit about the fellowship. We also established this in 2013. The idea was this, that there are a lot of FIFO speeches in Australia, you know, the fly-in, fly-out workers you hear about in Western Australia. But there's a lot of fly-in, fly-out speeches where someone arrives, comes, gives a speech, perhaps the same speech they gave in Singapore the week beforehand, and then they leave the country. And we wanted to do something different. We wanted to bring a scholar and a policymaker to Australia to have them with us for a number of weeks so that they can really imbibe the Australian debate, they can be part of the Australian debate, they can learn about Australia as well as teaching us about the world. The principal sponsor of the fellowship is Telstra, a wonderful corporate member of the Institute, and we thank them very much for their crucial support of this fellowship both last year and this year. We've had two very distinguished fellows in the last couple of years. First of all, prominent US diplomat Kurt Campbell, who was responsible for the pivot, and then Steve Hadley, who served as National Security Advisor to President George W. Bush. And I think you can see from their curriculum vitae that what we look for in distinguished international fellows is not just a scholar, not just somebody with insights into the world, but somebody who's been a policymaker at the very highest level. And those qualities certainly apply to this year's fellow, Ambassador Sham Saran. Ambassador Saran is an eminent career diplomat who has played an important part in India's rise in the world. He joined the Indian Foreign Service in 1970. He served in a number of capitals, including Beijing, Tokyo, and Geneva. He was ambassador to Myanmar, Indonesia, and Nepal, and High Commissioner to Mauritius. After a career spanning 34 years in the Indian Foreign Service, he was appointed Foreign Secretary in 2004 and held that position until his retirement in 2006. Since then, he has served as the Prime Minister's personal representative at important summits of the Group of 20, the Group of 8, and the UN climate change process. And as the PM's personal envoy, he helped to shape the historic US-India civil nuclear agreement. Until very recently, he served as chairman of India's National Security Advisory Board under the NSC. He is also chairman of the Research and Information System for Developing Countries and a senior fellow at the Centre for Policy Research, both in Delhi. Sham, thank you for coming to Australia for this fellowship. Thank you also for giving this lecture on Remembrance Day. I remember that you said a couple of days ago that often, because of your service as a diplomat in your country's name, you often were overseas during Remembrance Day, and you mentioned, I think, that sometimes in your own country the sacrifice and the service of Indian soldiers is not recognised as much as it could be. Well, again, you're overseas on this very solemn day, and we're sorry for that, but we're also pleased that we could mark this day together, given the long shared history and connection between our two nations, going right back to Gallipoli, of course, where Indian and Australian soldiers served together. So, ladies and gentlemen, so Sham, thank you very much for agreeing to be the Distinguished International Fellow, the Telstra Distinguished International Fellow for this year. And ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Saran to give the 2015 Owen Harries Lecture on the topic India Navigating a Contested Geopolitical Space. Sham Saran.
Thank you very much, Michael. And I promise not to make the same speech in Singapore. Dr. Michael Fulilov, Executive Director of the Lowy Institute, members of the faculty of the Institute, respected Mr. Owen Harries, Mrs. Harries, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. I wish to thank the Lowy Institute for inviting me to deliver the prestigious Owen Harries Lecture this year. It is an even greater privilege to have Mr. Harries personally present in this very distinguished audience. As the founder editor of the National Interest Journal from 1985 to 2001, he was one of the most influential voices in the United States and across the world on issues relating to international security and foreign policies. His writings and speeches reflect realism, but tempered by prudence and sagacity, born out of a lifetime of scholarship, deep historical insight, and hands-on experience. These qualities mark his valuable contributions to the discourse on international relations. Thank you, sir, for your presence here this morning, which makes this a very special occasion for me. In my remarks today, I will attempt to convey an overall perspective on how India looks at the world around us today. Where does India seek to locate itself in a geopolitical space which has and is likely to become even more contested among the major powers? And finally, what are the prospects of India achieving its objectives as a major emerging power? And let me begin by addressing a criticism which is often levied against Indian policy makers, and that is the apparent lack of what people call strategic culture, even a worldview, which provides countries with a consistent framework through which to understand the world around them and engage with it to advance a set of objectives, influenced, of course, by geography, by culture, by history, and also a certain identifiable national temperament. I can do no better than quote from Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, who articulated the sensibilities that drive the people of India and shape their view of the world and their place in it. He saw India as a civilizational entity coming into its own after a very long and eventful, and yes, a very painful journey to keep what he called its tryst with destiny. In describing the civilizational essence of India, this is what he said in words of unmatched eloquence. And I quote, "And yet India, with all her poverty and degradation, had enough of nobility and greatness about her, and though she was overburdened with ancient traditions and present misery, and her eyelids were a little weary, she had a beauty wrought from within upon the flesh, the deposit, little cell by little cell, of strange thoughts and fantastic reveries and exquisite passions. Behind and within her battered body, one could glimpse a majesty of soul. Though through long ages she had traveled and gathered much wisdom along the way and trafficked with strangers and added them to her own big family and witnessed days of glory and of decay and suffered humiliation and terrible sorrow and seen many a strange sight, but throughout her long journey, she had clung to her immemorial culture, drawn strength and vitality from it, and shared it with other lands," unquote. India's tryst with destiny in 1947 was a culmination of this journey, a chance to dream again. But Nehru saw that these were dreams not just for India, but, a quote, they are also for the world, because he saw prophetically a world too closely knit together to flourish in fragmented isolation. He welcomed the initial achievements of a rule-based multilateral order, which the United States, in a brief phase of enlightened self-interest, took the lead in creating. But he saw the swiftly emerging divisions of the Cold War as shrinking India's own hard-won space as an independent and sovereign nation, and non-alignment was a means to maintain India's strategic space to continue on its civilizational journey and not succumb again to having its destiny determined by others. But Nehru is long gone, the Cold War is over, and the world around us has been changing in ways that are profound and deeply uncertain. But the basic prism through which independent India has sought to engage with the world has remained remarkably consistent. We are witnessing the relentless dismantling of the post-Second World War global order, created and dominated by the United States and its Western allies. But the change is more rapid and far-reaching in some respects, perhaps less in others. For example, the most significant and visible is the continuing shift of the center of gravity of the global economy, international trade, and investment from the transatlantic to the trans-Pacific. The global financial and economic crisis of 2007-2008 has accelerated this trend. The recent slowdown in the Chinese economy and continuing inability of the Indian economy so far to regain a higher trajectory of growth may retard this trend, but it is unlikely to change it. The balance of military power is also changing, but more slowly. The US retains its predominance and global reach, but the capabilities of other major powers, in particular China, are growing at a faster pace. The use of asymmetric capabilities by states as well as non-state actors has also exposed the limits and efficacy of traditional military power. This has also led to the eruption of latent interstate conflicts and tensions, and this is evident in several parts of the world. The global landscape today is defined by a sharpening confrontation between the United States and China and the revival of tensions between the US and Russia. The Ukraine crisis has given China additional leverage as China has overcome its wariness of an emergent China at its doorstep and acquiesced in a virtual alliance with the latter. This has confronted India with a more complex and difficult challenge. In the aftermath of the Cold War, India could count on the support of both the United States as well as Russia in advancing some of its interests. That is no longer the case. The international financial and banking sector continues to be anchored in the West and operate according to the rules of the game evolved in the West over a considerable period of time. Here, too, change is evident, but it is more incremental in nature. The international role of the US dollar is being challenged by the steady internationalization of the Chinese renminbi, while this failure to accord a more influential role to emerging economies is leading to the creation of rival international financial institutions, such as the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank and also the BRICS Development Bank. The advance of technology is also impacting on the transformation of the geopolitical terrain. The newer domains of cyber and space pervade virtually all aspects of contemporary life. In some ways, they have provided states with new and powerful instruments of control, but at the same time empowered individuals and non-state actors as well. These new instruments can be put to positive as well as malefic uses. The cyber and space domain remain anarchic, and reaching consensus on even limited governance regimes has proved very difficult. As the world gets locked in an increasingly dense and interconnected web across these domains, national or regional boundaries provide no barriers to the swift spread of information and disinformation affecting markets, societies, and therefore interstate relations. States with significant capabilities in these domains will have an advantage in navigating the emerging geopolitical terrain. Against this background, how does India seek to advance its interests? What is the underlying template which guides its foreign and security policies? In my view, the template is India's concept of its own strategic neighborhood and the need to secure this neighborhood, which is seen as a prerequisite for the pursuit of any credible regional or global role. India considers the entire Indian subcontinent and the ocean space around the peninsula as its strategic neighborhood. This is the core from which historically political, economic, and cultural influences radiated outwards across the oceans to the east and the west, and across the mountain and deserts to the north and west towards Central Asia. This extended neighborhood, in turn, had a major influence in shaping India's identity as a very diverse and plural entity, but with a strong and enduring sense of cultural affinity. As India's external profile develops and expands, it is along these remembered pathways that it will begin to manifest itself. Nehru's eloquent narrative on India's worldview was inspired by this history as a crossroads culture, enriched by the long centuries of maritime interaction, both east and west, borne along the monsoon winds and the caravan routes that linked it to Central Asia and also China. The Indian subcontinent and the ocean space around it constitutes a single geopolitical unit with dense economic complementarities, a common history, and very strong cultural affinities. This remains a strategic singularity, despite being fragmented into several independent and sovereign states who do not have a shared security perception. However, as the largest entity, India's strategic compulsions are still defined by subcontinental imperatives. It cannot conceive of its defense within the confines of its own borders. The situation is made more complex by the fact that there are overlapping ethnicities, linguistic, and kinship ties which spill across national boundaries. There are shared assets like rivers and forests, but their use may be fragmented and contested. Since India's independence, Indian leaders have confronted the perennial dilemma of reconciling the country's subcontinental security imperatives with the reality of a divided polity. A Pax Indica, which could enable India to compel its neighbors into aligning their security perspectives with that of India, is a remote possibility. The alternative is to use a mix of political, security, economic, and cultural policies to create a dense web of interdependencies, which over time may lead to the alignment of security perspectives with that of India. The aim would be to try and transcend borders, not seek to erase them, and transform a contested space into one enjoying relative harmony and a broad political consensus. This has been the basic tenor of India's neighborhood strategy over the past decade and a half, but has achieved only partial success. While the geopolitical context has been changing, sometimes in dramatic ways, India's strategic calculations have continued to be influenced by two major developments which took place soon after its independence and have remained a continuing preoccupation with perhaps an even sharper edge today. One was the partition of India in 1947 and the subsequent conflict with Pakistan over Jammu and Kashmir. India's access to the Gulf and West Asia and to Central Asia was interrupted. In the East, the creation of East Pakistan and later Bangladesh reduced India's access to the sensitive Northeast region. And the connection was really reduced to a very narrow and threatened corridor. Two was the annexation of Tibet by China in 1950, which made India, for the first time in its history, a contiguous neighbor of a major and an inimical power, impinging directly on India's strategic space. Over the past several decades, it is the impact and persistent consequences of these two developments which have imparted a very complex dimension to India's effort to resolve its subcontinental dilemma, particularly with the emergence of a hostile Sino-Pakistan strategic alliance, which also has had a significant nuclear dimension. During the Cold War years, India's neighborhood policy was mostly defensive and reactive. However, the adoption of economic reforms and liberalization in the early 1990s and the improvement of relations with the US and the West generally led to the accelerated growth of the Indian economy and its steady globalization. This also provided the confidence as well as the means to pursue a different neighborhood strategy. Since the turn of the century, India became a champion of collaboration under the South Asia Association for Regional Cooperation, rather than see it as a ganging up of smaller neighbors against its interests. It has opened up its economy to its neighbors on a non-reciprocal basis, and this has led to a significant increase in trade. However, connectivity is still an issue, as are the cumbersome procedures at border crossings. It is unlikely that the essentially adversarial relations with China and with Pakistan will change in the near future. Neither the issue of Kashmir with Pakistan or the long-standing border issue with China are likely to be resolved for the time being. The challenge, therefore, lies in managing both relationships in a manner that prevents any open confrontation and armed conflict. With China, there has been greater success in keeping relations on an even keel, and mechanisms are in place to deal with incidents at the border. With Pakistan, the continuing use of cross-border terrorism as an instrument of state policy has made it difficult to develop relations in other fields, including trade, while reserving differences over Kashmir. China is one country which impacts, as I said, most directly on India's strategic space. The unresolved boundary issues, the shadow of the Tibet issue, the Chinese use of Pakistan as a very convenient proxy to constrain India, and now its increasing presence in the Indian Ocean. These are difficult issues which need to be managed carefully. There is the uncomfortable reality that the asymmetry between the two Asian giants is increasing. China is four times the size of India today, and the gap is likely to grow. This imbalance limits India's room for maneuver. India has attempted to deal with this challenge through a policy of engagement with China, building on areas of convergence, even while constraining its predilection towards unilateral and sometimes aggressive assertion of power. The latter requires expanding India's deterrent capabilities, including upgradation of infrastructure at the border, but also strengthening security ties with countries in the region who share our concerns over Chinese behavior. India has welcomed US rebalancing to Asia, but is unable to understand its posture leading to the crisis in Ukraine. Russia has been pushed closer to China, which is now the pivot in the triangular relationship among China, Russia, and the US. For India, the closer relationship China has with Russia has with China reduces the value of our long-standing and cooperative engagement with Russia. In dealing with India-China issues, even India-Pakistan issues in the future, Russia may not be as supportive as in the past. The US seems to have been concerned about the growing partnership between Putin's Russia and Germany, Europe's preeminent power. And the Ukraine crisis has soured Germany's relations with Russia. However, the US may be neglecting the even more serious inroads that China has been making in Europe, taking advantage of the continent's persistent economic and financial crisis. China has pushed ahead with its One Belt, One Road initiative, acquiring modern infrastructure and logistics bases across Europe. It is using the United Kingdom as a key base for developing its offshore currency markets. The US has been unable to restrain its European allies from embracing a much more expanded economic partnership with China, which could impact on the transatlantic security relationship. India's own relationship with Europe has fallen off the radar, even as its ties with Germany have expanded. In 2004, India and the European Union established a strategic partnership and acknowledged that each had a stake in the other's success as open, liberal, and plural democracies. However, with the financial and economic crisis afflicting most European countries, there has been a certain withdrawal from an active international role, and India is no longer an European priority. China, with its financial resources and large market, has proved to be a tempting partner, and Europe, in particular the United Kingdom, have allowed economic compulsions to override any political scruples. It is not only in Asia that China is attempting to create distance between the United States and its allies. The same is happening in Europe as well. I stated earlier that India's extended neighborhood extends to its western as well as to its eastern flank. The Gulf and West Asian region are of major interest to India for several reasons. It remains the key source of India's oil and gas supplies, even though there is a steady effort to diversify away to Africa and Latin America. There are 6 million Indians who live and work in the Gulf, and any political turmoil and violence would directly affect their welfare, and India may face the contingency of evacuating very large numbers of its citizens at exorbitant cost. India's access to Central Asia is through Iran, and this route is being further developed. This may also be affected by developments in the Gulf. Lastly, the sectarian conflict in the region, the growing proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the rise of ISIS as a brutal and fundamentalist Sunni entity, all these could have a negative impact on India's own secular social fabric. The spread of ISIS into our immediate neighborhood, including Afghanistan and Pakistan, would be a deeply disturbing development. The uncomfortable reality we face is that we may not be able to intervene to influence the course of events in this region. The Indian approach has been to expand its engagement not only with governments in the region, but also with the various informal and influential networks that exist in and across countries in the past, In the past, such engagements have proved critical in safeguarding the welfare of our citizens resident in the region. And this was how the large number of Indian nurses who were in Mosul when the ISIS took over, this is how we were able to, in fact, bring them out. It is on the eastern flank that India has focused much of its attention over the past couple of decades. The announcement of the Look East policy in 1992 began a process of re-engagement with its East Asian neighborhood. This re-engagement is most visible with ASEAN, where the initial dialogue partnership soon led to a summit partnership in 2002 and a strategic partnership in 2012. There has been a significant rise in trade and investment with ASEAN, and there is now a India-ASEAN Free Trade Investment and Service Agreement in place. There has also been significant rise in India's trade and investment relations with other countries in the region, including Japan and South Korea, with both of whom India has concluded comprehensive economic partnership agreements. A similar agreement is likely to be reached with Australia, hopefully in the next few months. While there is no trade agreement of a similar kind with China, it is one of India's largest trade partners and increasingly an important investor in India. Thus, over recent years, a very dense web of economic and trade links have been built up with countries of East Asia, and the region has emerged as the most dynamic component of India's external economic relations. This has now been paralleled by a network of defense and security relationships with several ASEAN and East Asian countries, with a particular focus on maritime security. In this respect, the most significant development has been the expansion of India-US maritime cooperation in the Asia-Pacific, with the US conducting the largest number of naval exercises with India. There is a possibility that the idea of a quad, including India, Japan, Australia, and the US, may be revived despite the strong opposition of both China and Russia. With China building artificial islands and bases in the South China Sea and asserting claims over virtually the entire ocean space, it would only be prudent to have a strong and credible counterforce available. However, India continues to advocate, as an alternative, an inclusive security architecture in the region that can take care of the legitimate concerns of China as well as other stakeholders. India has a substantial naval fleet and has increased its presence in the South China Sea and Western Pacific. This is likely to continue as India plans to devote a larger proportion of resources to its navy in the coming years. India sees its naval strength as compensating to some extent the subcontinental dilemma I mentioned earlier in my remarks. It should come as no surprise that India's major preoccupations remain rooted in its immediate and extended neighborhood. Nevertheless, it sees its expanded engagement with other major powers as positive factors in managing those preoccupations. The Modi government has pursued a remarkably active regional and global foreign policy, which he also seeks to leverage to advance India's economic prospects. In addition to a sense of itself as a civilizational entity, India has an area, population, resources, and capabilities which assure it a global profile. While its indices of per capita and social welfare may still lag far behind developed countries, it has a large global and macro impact because of its sheer weight in the global economy. Choices India makes on its energy security or the progress it achieves on global health issues, such as the eradication of polio, have a decisive impact on tackling a range of global challenges, such as climate change or the ability to handle global pandemics. In areas such as cyber and space, India has developed substantial capabilities which could place it among the front-ranking nations of the future. In any rulemaking in these domains, India will have a role to play. And importantly, in an increasingly globalized and densely interconnected world, managing diversity and plurality will increasingly become the hallmarks of successful societies, and India fortunately retains its cosmopolitan temper. If success in the future will belong to knowledge societies, which can manage plurality, then India remains a promising candidate. It goes without saying that global interest in India will be linked to its economic performance. Should India be able to regain a high growth trajectory of 9 to 10% per annum for the next 20 years and achieve this without sacrificing ecological sustainability, it will become one of the leading powers of the current century. The election of Prime Minister Modi with an unprecedented parliamentary majority in 2014 has opened up prospects for India finally delivering on its acknowledged economic promise. It would also demonstrate that plural and sometimes messy democracy need not be a constraint on rapid development. Indeed, it may prove to be the one key ingredient of sustainable and inclusive development. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. No, thank you so much. Well, thank you very much, Shyam, for a terrific lecture. Very interesting. Was global and intelligent and concerned with the global environment and power, which is appropriate for the Harry's lecture. I also enjoyed it because and one reason we wanted to invite you to be the Distinguished International Fellow is that often in Australia, discussions about Asia are shrunk to the dimensions of China. So it's wonderful to hear a different perspective on our region and on the globe from the national of another very significant power in Asia. I'm also delighted to hear you say that messy democracy is not a hindrance to development, which is good news for Australia, given we've had five prime ministers in 5 years. The ambassador is happy to take questions for about 20 minutes, and I'm going to kick off with one or two while everybody collects their thoughts. First of all, can I ask you about Russia? Because, as you say, there's been a long-standing comity and relationship between Russia and India. How much discomfort is there in Delhi and in India with the behaviour of Mr. Putin's Russia in the last couple of years? And I'm thinking in particular of the breaching of the central tenet of the state system by when Russia not only meddled in the affairs of its neighbour Ukraine, but actually acquired a big chunk of its territory through the use of force, something which runs counter to all the rules of the international system that we all support. And secondly, its intervention in Syria, which is obviously calculated to prop up an ugly client regime rather than to ameliorate the tragic effects of an awful civil war that's led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. How much, obviously there are long-standing national interests between India and Russia that transcend individual leaders, but how much discomfort do you think there is about the new Russia?
Let me say that with the end of the Cold War, the kind of strategic glue which brought India and Russia together for about 30 years, almost from 1960 to 1990, which was essentially a shared concern about China, that ended in 1990. You will note that from 1990 onwards, there was a very significant warming of relations between China and Russia. In fact, though Russia was one of the chief suppliers of modern weapons to India, from that time onwards, it started becoming a major weapon supplier to China as well. There was already a very major change in the relationship between India and Russia, but relationships which have been developed over a long period of time do not just fall away overnight. Russia has continued to be a very valued partner for India, particularly because even with the improvement of relations with China, we saw some wariness on the part of Russia over the emergence of China next door. And as I said, the very positive relationship which was established between Russia and the West with the United States, that was very welcome to India. Because my own experience was, for example, while getting the waiver from the nuclear suppliers group for India, if Russia and the United States had not actually worked together to advance India's case, given the opposition of China and some other countries, it might have been very difficult to get that. So we had a certain vested interest in the good partnership between Russia and the West. I think with respect to Ukraine, the Indian position is not that we support Mr. Putin's takeover of Crimea, but the events leading up to that point. Perhaps there was a kind of conduct on the part of the United States and some of the Western countries, which perhaps provoked events in a certain direction. Our criticism of the United States on this issue is that if you consider China to be the chief challenge or the major challenge that you are going to be facing for the next few decades, then having Russia on the side of China doesn't make sense. What has happened is that even in the confrontation over Ukraine, not taking an ethical position, but purely as a professional diplomat, I would say that you do not try to exacerbate a confrontation where the other side has greater stake than you have. It was always clear that Russia would have much greater stake in Ukraine. The West, the United States, would not go to war in order to defend Ukraine. So why provoke a confrontation which the other side has more equity than you have? So to us, it seemed that it was not quite well handled, that perhaps this could have been, it is maybe speculative, but perhaps it could have been handled in a different way. So not supporting what Russia may have done in terms of the acquisition of territory from Ukraine, but we certainly believe that perhaps the course of events may not have been what they actually proved to be. So that's the issue. And with respect to Syria, again, we have a slightly different perspective. Both Syria and Iraq may have been, totalitarian states, but they were also, to our mind, very importantly secular states. They did have space for different ethnicities, different religious groups. To us, it seemed that the kind of conflict which began in Syria was very much related to an effort on the part of certainly some of the Sunni regimes in the region, perhaps encouraged by the West, to isolate Iran. So Syria was not important in itself, but Syria became important because this could be one way of trying to isolate Iran. But the long-term consequences have been actually very negative. And to be fair, India, four or five years ago, pointed out that this kind of an intervention, which is focused on regime change, but does not look at what I call the morning after, is something that needs to be rethought. Because unless you are able to sustain your involvement, unless you are able to sustain your engagement, you will end up with the kind of situation we have in Syria, the kind of situation, for example, we have in Libya. In several of these places, the intervention which has not been sustained and there has not been stomach for that kind of engagement has led to a worse situation than we started off with. And that's something that perhaps we need to think about.
All right, thank you. Who would like to ask a question? I saw this gentleman and then Tom in the front row. Yes, if we can get a microphone to the gentleman in the middle.
Thanks. You spoke at the beginning of your address about India's cultural connections with its region and about the Nehruvian vision of a pluralistic India. The day that this lecture was announced by the Lowy Institute, I read a piece by you that spoke very strongly about the impact of Hindutva politics on the Indian polity. What impact do you think domestic Hindu fundamentalist politics is having on India's capacity to operate in a multilateral environment and to stake its claim as a leading exponent of non-alignment?
Well, there is no doubt that there is concern about some of the trends we see. And by the way, it's not just the Hindu nationalists, but we also have a problem from the other side. I mean, there is also a growing kind of fundamentalism which you see in sections of the Muslim society in India. So it's something which only a plural democracy and rules of the game can manage. And India so far has actually managed, despite the fact that there have been a few setbacks along the way. I think I'm very optimistic for the reason that even when there has been this kind of a eruption of those fundamentalist trends, there has been a huge pushback. Whether it is from Indian writers or artists or civil society people, intellectuals, this has been something which is very heartening. And I cannot see India actually succeeding as a secular democracy if it does not retain space for all its diversity. It is absolutely fundamental to the success of India. And I also believe that while there may be assault on this from the right or the left or from this kind of fundamentalism or another kind of fundamentalism, the core of the Indian society continues to be very, very, as I said, almost cosmopolitan in character.
Thank you. The next question is from Tom Switzer from Radio National. If you just wait for a mic, Tom.
Thank you, Michael. Ambassador, you mentioned the Islamic State, the Sunni jihadists in Iraq and Syria primarily. I think in the course of the last 12 to 18 months, there have been something like 20,000 foreign recruits to the Islamic State. India, it's quite intriguing. By most counts, there are something like 20 Indians who have left the country to fight for the Islamic State. Now, 20 Indians out of a population of 180 million Indian Muslims is very low indeed. If you look at Australia, we've had something like 200 foreign recruits to the Islamic State out of about 500,000 Muslim population. Question, how is it that Indian Muslims are far less likely to radicalise?
Precisely for the reason that I mentioned, that even though there may be fringe elements on both sides or on different sides, the core of India, Muslim or Hindu or Christian or Sikh, remain very, very tolerant and accommodating. And this is not something which is only recently emerged. This is, you know, the civilization of India. So the reason why we believe the vast majority of Muslims are not attracted by this is because they are part and parcel of a mainstream where they feel quite comfortable. They feel that their rights are safeguarded, that they have the space to practice their religion, whatever culture they believe in. So as long as that space is available and they do not feel threatened in that space, why should they be attracted to something which is, in a sense, a kind of a violent reaction to either real or imagined grievances?
All right, thank you. All right, this gentleman in the second row.
Thank you. Ambassador, I was wondering if you could say a few words about recent developments in Nepal, whether you think that reflects a failure in diplomacy under the Modi government, whether India has legitimate domestic security concerns coming out of the treatment of minorities in Nepal, or whether it's a fallback to past ways of doing things with India's neighbours.
Well, you know, the...
Perhaps you could explain what's happened recently for those of us who are not following it as much as...
So, Nepal has been engaged in a constitution-making exercise for the past several years. And the basic principles on which a new constitution should be based was already a matter of broad political consensus amongst the major political parties, which was that it would be an inclusive constitution. It would have no discrimination against various ethnic groups which make up Nepal. People seem to think of Nepal as being, in fact, a somewhat relatively more homogeneous country than India. But nothing could be further from the truth. Nepal is almost as diverse as India is because it has so many different ethnic groups, linguistic groups. So the basic principle that there should be space again for all the different groups, some of whom were who felt persecuted or oppressed during the monarchical regime. This was something which was agreed upon. What has happened is that when it came to the principle of federation, what is the federal setup which would be most appropriate to Nepal? And this is something which Nepal has to determine, not India. Those groups, large groups in the plains areas and some hill areas as well, felt that the manner in which these units, component units of the federation were being delineated would in fact would dilute their own majority. So if you have instead of, for example, a relatively homogeneous unit in the plains area, but you link it together with also a few districts of the hill areas, then you know the autonomy and the political influence of the major ethnic group would decline. So there was a reaction to this, that this is an attempt to try and somehow prevent those which are newly emergent groups from in fact having autonomy. Now India's problem is mainly because we have an open border. We do not have, you know, immigration controls. People can walk freely back and forth across this border. And any kind of disruption which takes place in that particular area naturally spills over into India because of the open borders. So it does cause a security concern for India. And the other problem is that the inability of the central government in Nepal to handle this eruption of protest in this region, they then look for who can they blame for this. And India has always been a very, very readily available scapegoat for that. To say that India is trying to encourage these groups because they have kinship ties across the border is really not telling the whole story, because India actually has kinship ties not only with the people in the plains, but also people in the hill areas. You know, there are something like 6 to 8 million Nepali citizens. I'm not talking about Indian citizens of Nepali origin, but Nepali citizens out of a population of 22 or 23 million who live and work in India. There are a very large number of veterans from the Indian Army. You know, the Indian Army still continues to recruit a very large number of what are called Gurkhas from the, and all of them are from the hill areas. And a lot of them are spread all over Nepal, and they have very strong ties with India. So it is not as if our ties are limited only to those who are living in the plains. These are ties which are spread across the whole of Nepal. And India will have a sense of threat if there is any foreign power establishes a hostile presence in Nepal. So what is happening today is that we are trying to see how the political controversies which have arisen, is there some way in which India can promote a consensus that satisfies all the different groups, because it is quite clear that a departure from what was considered to be a broad political consensus in favor of inclusive democracy, if you depart from that and you try to retain a sort of privileged position for some groups, that is simply not going to work. And not only because the plains people are protesting against it, there are a lot of other groups which similarly feel persecuted are reacting to it. It is not in India's interest that there should be continued unrest in the country. So I presume that a certain effort is being made to try and use our good offices to see how this can be settled.
I might ask the last question if I can, Ambassador, and bring it closer to home. I know you're speaking next week in Melbourne about the Australia-India relationship, but for the audience today, what's the future of the Australia-India relationship? Obviously, there was something of a bromance between Mr. Modi and Mr. Abbott, but there are lots of common interests between our two countries. So when you look ahead at the bilateral relationship, what do you see?
Well, as a strategist, what I see is that, as India's own profile begins to expand eastwards, and Australia's profile starts expanding more westward, this whole ocean space between our two countries has become a very, very strategic space. And whether peace and security prevails in that space is vital to the interests of Australia. It is vital to the interests of India. So I see this being a very, very strong foundation for a continuing and a sustained, strategic relationship between our two countries. In addition to that, if India is to maintain a growth rate of 9 to 10%, as I mentioned, that cannot be possible without very strong partnerships. And not only in terms of, accessing minerals from Australia, but a whole host of other areas where Australia can be actually a very important partner for India. And I think that is beginning to be a kind of a strong perception amongst decision makers in India in a manner that was not the case before. So we have had romances earlier, but those romances somehow petered out. I think this time round, I do believe that this is perhaps for keeps, because there are reasons why it makes sense for India and Australia to work together. And although I have been here only for a few days, but I get a sense that in Australia too, there is perhaps a different perception of India today than was the case a few years back.
Well, I certainly hope the relationship between India and Australia is now for keeps. Ladies and gentlemen, you've seen a sense of the breadth of Ambassador Saran. He's as confident talking about Nepali politics on the plains as grand geopolitics and the contested space of the Indian Ocean. You can see, I think, that he's a worthy Distinguished International Fellow and indeed a worthy person to deliver the Owen Harries Lecture. So please join me in thanking Shyam Saran.